My pleasure to introduce tonight's main speaker, Danny B. from Austin, Texas.
My name's Danny. I'm an alcoholic. Well, I want to thank Bob for inviting me over here, going to Las Vegas. I mean, it really had to twist my arm. I'll find out how much I really wanted to come when I leave. And I met Shelton. I think his name's Sheldon. Is that his name? It's like taking a drink out of a fire hose. He has a lot to say. My new buddy, he opened up to us without any prompting whatsoever. And everybody was just a silence. He said his dog has a credit card. I never knew a dog that had that, the one that lived. Anyway, well, that's it. How about this? Is this better? That's pretty loud, isn't it? No? Have I introduced myself yet? Well, my name is Danny. I'm an alcoholic from Austin, Texas. And by the grace of God and working this program, best I know how, I've been sober since February the 18th of 81. And my folks, thank you very much for that. I was just thinking when Smitty, who Dr. Bob's son, Smitty was he moved to Texas after a good while. A lot of you people probably know around here that he did a lot of talking, and he was a great Al-Anon, and really he had a sense of humor that was just wonderful. And he had a story that he liked to tell, and you may have heard it. I certainly have, because I've told it a dozen times, and I really like it because I think it has a good message for us. But he talks, the story's about the two moose hunters from Texas who are very wealthy drunks. And every year they would go up north, and they would go up into the north country, and they would get a bush pilot to take them in, and they'd land on a lake. And they'd taxi over, and they'd get their guns and their gear and get off, and he'd leave them there with all their whiskey for about a week, and they would drink and party and shoot. And when this new bush pilot come to get him, he come in and he landed. He just started with the company, and he landed, and he pulled, taxied up there, and there they were. And they were drunk, and they had all their gear, and they had two big old moose with them. And he looked around, and he thought, there's no way that I can get out of here with all that weight. So he told the guys, he said, we can't take off with that much weight. And one of them said, well, why not? We did it last year. And he thought about it, and he said, well, they're good customers, and he wouldn't want to lose them. So he said, well, all right, get everything in. And they took off and made it about 200 yards, and they crashed. And one of them drunks popped up out of the wreckage and said, where are we? And the other one said, oh, we're about 100 yards from where we crashed last year. And that was the story of my life. And I love that. I started out with nothing and drank that up. My first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was sometime in late December of 1979. And I got here because my wife had just kicked me out of the car in front of the club. I didn't want to go. I didn't even know what it was. I resisted, but I was sick. I had a swollen liver, and I was worn down. I had hepatitis, and I'd been on a week-long drunk, and she wanted me out of the car because she had a date with her boyfriend. And I didn't want to go because I thought it was going to ruin our marriage. But I went into that club to try to get a ride to get out of there, you know, and go save my marriage. You know, alcoholics are busy, you know. I mean, I didn't have a job, and everybody in the world had hot checks everywhere. I mean, I was busy, and I had my marriage was on the rocks. And I go in there to that club, and they said, they saw me coming in. There was some old-timers there. They sat around and played gin, and they saw me coming in. They brought me on in, offered me orange juice and honey. I thought, what for? And they talked to me for a good long while, and the theme seemed to be, if you don't take a drink, you won't get drunk. And after a while, I thought, I get that. And I think you're right, and I'll keep that in mind. But I'm not really right now, I'm not really interested in this sort of line of thinking. My wife has got a boyfriend. So they finally told me if I'd stay for the meeting, that I would, if I'd just stay for the meeting, that they'd give me a ride home. So I stayed, and there was just, it seemed like it was really long because I'm starting to sober up. And when the meeting was over, they all jumped up and held hands and said the Lord's Prayer. And when it was over, they just burst into merriment. And it's like just like Moses parting the sea, it seemed to me that it just parted, and there was this flat top guy headed straight for me named Gene Grimes. He's dead now. He headed to me, and he had two young guys with me, and I thought, great, here comes my ride. And he walked up to me, and he said, he told me who he was, and he said, we're going to Baskin-Robbins for ice cream. Would you like to go? And I thought, be still, my beating heart. Baskin-Robbins for ice cream. And in my mind, what I thought was, there is no way on God's green earth that I'm going to go out with a bunch of geriatrics for ice cream while my wife is out with her boyfriend. That ain't happening. And what came out of my mouth was, sure, I'd love to go. So I'm standing over there holding a melting Rocky Road ice cream and having AA explained in depth to me. And if you're new here tonight, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I know you're thrilled to be here. I know that's what my feeling was. You know, you think, well, great, I've made it to AA. Well, and you know what? It is great. It's about the greatest thing that ever happened in my life. I will say this. I don't want to forget to say this. Of all the events that have happened in my recorded history, in the years I've been on the planet, there is nothing that comes even close to comparing with the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is absolutely off the hook, the greatest thing ever. It works for anybody who's willing to do this deal. Give it a shot. Hang in here. Don't take a drink. You won't get drunk. And you won't want to take a drink if you'll do what we do. Anyway, had I eaten my ice cream yet? Got carried away. Well, it melted, and I never ate it, really. I just stood there listening to them talk. Gene said, if you don't take a drink, you won't get drunk. And the kid was with him, said, let me explain it to him. He said, look, it's not the caboose that kills you. It's a locomotive. And I thought, I should have brought pencil and paper. I know this is going to be helpful, but, you know, right now I've got a lot of things to do. And so that was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. I would have told you for years after that was the most pointless thing that ever happened in my life. I know today that that was a very serendipitous moment. When I got pushed out of that car and walked in there, something happened that has to happen, and I had met sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd met people that are like me, and they were happy and they were sober. Now, I wasn't quite ready yet. My sponsor used to say, Danny, you know, you go on and get you something to drink if you don't like what we have, because we certainly don't want to sober up an innocent man. And I loved Harold. You know, and in Texas, they're pretty blunt, and they probably are here. By the way, I want to say something about your cake. I was very shocked when I saw it. We don't do it like that. And it looked to me, I told Carol, I said, the cake looks like hell if you don't know the truth of it. I said, I don't want any of it, you know. But after a while, I caught on. You've been using that a long time, I take it. Yeah, well, we're not all that bright back that way, you know. That's one of the good things about Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't really have to be all that smart to get it. In fact, the smarter you are, the more disappointed we are to hear it. You know, we like simple. Simple works for us, you know. It's just really, anyway. So I'll just tell you real briefly, I was born to children. My mother was 14, my dad was 19, and they had me a year later. He was in the Second World War. He was a naval officer, or not officer, he was a Navy man. He was aboard the USS California, and he saw a lot of action. And when he came back from the war, he was an angry man. He had a lot of things that had seen a lot of things, and he was pretty twisted up. He was one of the greatest generation. I talk about my dad because he's like a central theme in my life. My dad was my hero. When he came back home, even though he was getting mad and blow up and have all these fits and he had a bad drinking problem, he adored me. And he would play with me out in the backyard out down in South Texas until we were exhausted. And I had a vivid memory of just laying down in the backyard and putting my head on his bare chest, and he'd just pat my head, and I felt safe. And my life was okay when I was with him. And this disease just tore us apart. And we went for years, we didn't even talk. You mentioned my name and he turned the other way. He buried himself in work and in cigarettes. He had no skills for communicating his disappointment and his sense of shame. He was a hard-working, honest man. My mother was just a child. She grew up with me. They did everything they could. They gave me a home. They gave me something to eat. They didn't read me stories, and I didn't have dreams. I didn't dream that I would be something when I grew up. I had nightmares. I was restless, irritable, and discontented from almost the time I could remember. I had shingles by the time I was 6 years old. By the time I was 9 years old, I had two younger brothers, and they were my job to take care of them. And I was a guardian. I took care of my younger brothers. I carried them with me everywhere I went. My mom and dad both worked, and so they were mine. But by the time I was 13 years old, I had a meltdown, and I couldn't concentrate. I couldn't stay in school. I didn't know. No one knew what was wrong with me. I lied. I stole. I was belligerent. I lived in a fantasy world, and they put me in a mental institution in Big Springs, Texas, and I was there for 3 months. I got out. The only thing they introduced me to was psychotropic drugs. When I got out, I had my first drink. I had my first drink with some guys. I drank because I wanted to impress them, and the first drink really didn't, it burned. And the second drink, I just drank it because we're still doing it, and the third drink, I thought, I'm going to steal the bottle and leave. Because I felt, it just kind of started to warm me up, and it set me free. And for the first time that I could remember, with people that I didn't know and that I was impressed by and afraid of, I could just relax and I could just be me. And it turned out I was an incredible person all night. So I wrecked my mother's car. I'd stolen my mom's car to go out and do all this. I wrecked it. They decided that I'd gotten out of the institution a little early. So I went back. And when I went back this time, I tried to escape, so they put me on a locked ward. And they're giving shock treatments. And they threatened me. They said, if you leave, you'll get them. And so I'm sitting here, and they've also, they're giving me Thorazine. Thorazine is a weird drug. It's not the kind of thing that a guy like me is interested in. Because what it does, it slows your motor skills down. You can't go anywhere. But it doesn't do a whole lot to your brain. It works. You just sit there and think. I've never wanted a drug that did that. It's the other way around. I want something that slows this down and lets me go. My favorite thing in life became, I like speed and whiskey. I want to do a line of speed, start drinking whiskey, and go out and make friends. Just go introduce myself. How you doing? Good to talk to you. Anyway, while I was in there, I made my two first really close friends. They were getting shock treatments. They were from my hometown. And as they were getting these shock treatments, their ability to interact with me began to wear off. And so I devised a plan. And on Visitor's Day, I stole a car from a visitor. and got these two guys out of there, and we hoofed it to Midland, Texas, 40 miles away, and picked up two more guys who should have been in that hospital. And we headed for Mexico, which is 242 miles from Midland, Texas. And we're on our way, and way we got funds is we would just stop in mom and pop places and go in and get beer and bologna, and we would just create a diversion so we could steal this. And when you're escaped mental patients, creating a diversion is no problem. So we're siphoning gas and drinking beer and eating bologna and heading south, and this is a great adventure, and I'm having a really good time. I'm in charge. It's my gang. This is Plan B. And as we head that way and we stop to get out, these guys' meds begin to wear off, and it became clear they were in there for a reason. You know, I mean, we'd get out of the car and it'd take me an hour to gather my gang up and get them back in the car. You know, they'd just wander off everywhere. We make it across the border and I sold the car to a taxi driver. And we're over in Boys Town, and that's when I realized that I'm at the end of Plan B. This is all I knew to do. We're here. So I'm having a drink, and all of a sudden I get to hear this commotion. And then one of the guys I was with had just gotten in a fight, and he killed a parrot that belonged to a woman that lived down there. She was working there, and started a big commotion. We got in a big fight, and we decided we better get out of there, so we headed back for the United States. We got to the international border, and the federales threw down on us, and we went to jail in Mexico. And, you know, in the big book it says, the alcoholic's problems pile up on him and become astonishingly difficult to solve. This was very difficult. I don't speak the language at all. You know, I mean, I don't even know what adios means. And I don't know how to tell him I want my mother. But that's, you know, that's pretty much what I wanted to say, you know. But my mom has all those skills that you need. That she's headed for Al-Anon in about 23 or 4 years. But she right now she has reached a point in her life where her husband and her two kids that she has, they barely exist. She expects them to take care of themselves because she's on a mission to save number one son. She is focused on me. I called it secondary narcissism. You know. I'm narcissistic to the nth degree. It's all about me. And in her case, it was all about me too. You know. So the rest of the family fell apart, but she found me. I don't know. And she, you know, and it's really funny. She has a completely different story about this whole episode, which is amazing. I like my story a lot better. But then some of my fondest memories never happened. You know. I just... If you're new here tonight, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I also want you to pay attention. We in Alcoholics Anonymous have a basic text. It's a big book. And if you read in the big book, if you go back and begin to read all the preface and all in that area in there, you'll find out that at some point in 1939, they said we quit our flying blind period. Up until that point, it's what it says in Baba. They said we were flying blind. We didn't even have a name. We took the name Alcoholics Anonymous from the name that we give the big book. And that was not our original choice. But we suddenly had a name, and we had a direction. We had a book. We had a book of directions. Get that book and follow those directions. Find somebody who has done this and do it with them. Just throw caution to the wind and look, and reach for the all that you can have in life. I just want to point out to you, it's very important that you do that like right away, because tonight your speaker is an escaped mental patient. You know, and they never did discharge me, by the way. I'm just still gone. You know, and if you look around you here tonight, if you're new, look at the people around you. I mean, these people, we're all in here. We relate to you. We have We have been to prisons, to skid rows, to mental institutions. We've destroyed our lives, our children's lives. We've destroyed marriages. We've ruined businesses, and we'd like to guide you into your new life. So it's very important. It's very, very important that you find something that's solid and stick with that. Because a lot that you hear in Alcoholics Anonymous just isn't all that helpful. You know, so anyway, we were in jail in Mexico. My mother found me, and she got me out of there. Only me. She didn't get those other guys out because she thought they were a bad influence on me. And got me back over across the border. And so we're back across the border, and those guys are still over there. I always wondered if they ever got out or at least learned the language, you know. But I got out, and I went on and joined the Navy. In the Navy, I really started drinking in earnest. I got big, and I started when I was in Guam. And probably Guam was the incubating period of my alcoholism. Because I said over there, Guam's about 14 miles long, and at its widest, about 9 miles wide. And I was a CB, and we drank, and we fought, and we played. And I liked being in the military. I liked drinking. I liked drinking San Miguel beer. I liked drinking mixed drinks. I liked drinking wine. I just liked drinking. I drank just exactly what the doctor said. I drank essentially because I like the effect it produces. The problem is that I crossed some invisible line where I no longer had a choice when it came to drinking. I wound up with this allergy to alcohol, and then I had this obsession to feel that way again. The way I felt when I met those guys when I was 13, 14 years old. I wanted to feel that way again, over and over and over again. And I would drink. When I wasn't drinking, I would just implode. And people would be, you know, I don't know about you, but when I didn't drink, people would say, "You're doing so good." And I think, "Really?" Yeah, they'd say, "Yeah, you are, you know. I mean, you're holding down a job," and I'm thinking about suicide, you know. And it says that the alcoholic roars through the lives of others. He's like a tornado roaring through the lives of others. It says we uproot relationships, and it's just, you know, it's terrible. When I don't drink, that tornado is internalized, and it's in me. When I'm sitting here and everybody else in my life is happy, and I'm sitting here and that's roaring in me emotionally, I'm disconnected from anything spiritual in life. My emotions and my mind and my thoughts, they govern each other. I have lots of information about life. Almost none of it's true. And I use it, you know. You know, do you ever wonder where thoughts come from? I mean, they just go running through your head. I got spiritual flypaper. I just catch them and look at them. And then I form all kinds of ideas about life about it. I never thought to ask anybody if they were true or not. I took that kind of thinking and these messed up emotions, and I would try over and over again to not drink. And man, it just wouldn't happen for me. I wound up getting kicked out of the Navy. I escaped from that island. I didn't want to escape. I just got to drinking with some British sailors, and we went and got on their ship because they said they had brandy rations. We left. Which is very difficult for me. There's no way that I can pass myself off as a British sailor. It just ain't happening. So I got back, you know, and I got kicked out of the Navy. I got a general discharge when they realized they had an escaped mental patient. They thought they'd better let me go. And I started hitting skid rows. I lived on skid row in Los Angeles, San Diego, all up and down the coast. I learned to sell blood and hustle pool. I know to hustle people to live off my wits. And I drank. And I made it. I left there. I went to Texas. In Texas, I started stealing. I started running with a gang, with a bunch of guys who were stealing oil field stuff. And first thing you know, I'm in prison in Texas, you know, and I did 3 years in prison in Texas, and I got out, and I did probably the only time I can ever remember acting on something my mother told me. She said, "Son, what you need is a job, a kid, a car, and a bank account, a house. You'll be okay." And so I went looking for a woman that had kids and a bank account and a job. I married her. And now my mother was wrong. That was the worst 2 weeks of my life. I left her and went back to my bar. I'm down at my bar working on Plan B, and I saw a woman in the bar that she was crying. I went over and talked to her, and her problem was that she was pregnant and she couldn't go home. Her family wouldn't have her home because she was unwed. And as we drank, I got to crying because I didn't have a home to go to, and we decided to get married. So we got married right away, and I called my mother and told her, and she said, "Oh my God, you have a wife." And I thought, details. I'm a big picture guy, and this is just, but I thought, I'm going to go ahead and go on my honeymoon. So we got a fifth of whiskey and got on a Greyhound bus and went from Odessa, Texas to McAllister, Oklahoma. We got to McAllister, Oklahoma. I was lit. Got off that bus, and my new father-in-law was there to pick us up. He was a wealthy man. He had a chauffeur-driven limousine. And we got in the car, went to his house, a big, huge mansion. I passed out. I woke up. I went out on the veranda and looked across the street. I saw his place of business. I had married the warden of McAllister Prison's daughter. I thought, you should just get a hobby. I mean, what's the chances of this, you know? So you can appreciate it. I was very, very uncomfortable in that relationship. So I went back to my bar. I married another girl after I got, my mom devised a plan and got me out of there. They moved me to a dry county and got me a job and got me a divorce and an annulment, you know, and I got me this job in a mohair plant. This is the worst thing job you can imagine. I've got this job, and it's dry down there, right? And so I'm standing there, and I got my scissors, and I stand at a loom, and it's mohair. It makes it into a rope, and it just coils into this barrel. And I'm supposed to stand there with my scissors, and when the barrel's full, which takes about 20 minutes, I cut it. I move that barrel, and I put another one there. I lasted about 3 hours. I was on my way back to Odessa, Texas. I got back to Odessa and I did what I needed to do. I got married. Married this little old girl, but this time my use of alcohol and amphetamines has made me so psychotic and dangerous to be around. I may break down crying. I may start a fist fight. I may black out and wind up in jail. God knows what I'm going to do. My wife left me in order to save her life. And then when she did that, in a short period thereafter, she was involved in a car wreck and she was killed. And I went on a big crime spree of running drunk with another guy. And it culminated with me getting thrown in prison. And I got what I did. I broke into a bar. I was going to burglarize it, but... hell, we decided to stay and party. So I wasn't that hard to catch, and I wound up, got 10 years in prison. I got to prison. I implemented every good thing I knew to do. I got a GED. I started going to college. I took counseling. I decided that what my problem was that I didn't have an education. And I didn't have a trade, and what I needed to do was get all that and I could live out in the world. And I did all those things in my best effort at having what I thought was a normal, good, useful life. And when I got out of prison, I got a job. I was doing okay for a while, but then I took a drink. And it just spiraled down. And what happened, of course, is I wound up with hepatitis, hiding from my parole officer, running with the same old people, doing the same old things, blacking out, doing what I didn't want to do, asking myself how to get started again and what happened to my resolve when I got out of prison. And so that's when that gal kicked me out of the damn car. You know, she was tired of it. And I found you. And I never know what to say to you guys. I mean, the faces out here change, but this is Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the hearts and the minds attuned to the welfare of others coming together regularly to find out how do you transmit to this guy and that girl what has been given you with such little effort. We talk about the big book, you know? But from page, what is it, 23 or 24, where it says that here is a man who has we have no effective mental defense against the first drink, to over in where it talks about how we feel safe and protected. We just feel like that we don't even have to worry about not drinking. We're just free. It's only about 60 pages worth of work. Just real things. Not much at all. This is what we do. We've been given a gift. I've been given access to a power that I didn't even believe in. And I certainly didn't think he would have anything to do with me. I had my last drink. I've worked these steps. And I have been an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know any other way of life. If you want to ask anybody who knows me what defines Danny Brown, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. People say, what do you do for a living? Well, right now I'm an arborist. You know, I was an electrical contractor for 20 years. But that's just what I do to make money. This is my life. This is what I'm about. This, when everything falls apart, as it sometimes does in recovery, you drag yourself in here and get reminded that what's happening to you, God will handle. You made a deal with him. When you took the third step, did you mean it? You made a decision to turn your will and life over to his care. If you took that, you leave your life right there and you go over and talk to this guy and this gal over here and tell them about the nature of the disease. Share with them what happened to you and offer what you have. If you don't have the answer, drag them to your sponsor. Maybe he does. But get involved. And that's what I've done. I always end my stories the same way, and since I don't want to get that bell to go off, I'm gonna tell you the few things. I did my fourth step, and it was a very thorough fourth step. I prayed on my knees and with the third step, and then I wrote that inventory. I did the fifth step, and when it was over, my sponsor said, "What's evolved here is a liar, a cheat, a thief, a con artist. And if you want to live like that, you do not need any help. You're very good at it." He said, "But if you want to live this way of life, you're going to have some help. And I can't supply it for you. You're going to have to go down and ask that power into your life." And I went down to Town Lake, and when my foot just touched the ground out of that old car I was living in, I felt this power wash over me, and I knew that I was in the presence of God himself. To me, it was the power of the universe. I knew I was forgiven. I knew I'd never have to live the way I'd lived ever again. And I just thought, this is wonderful. With some help, I wrote my eight-step list, and I got active. I got about doing my nine-step stuff, and I was amazed. Before I was halfway through, I had a little apartment. I had friends. All my friends are sober, and I'm ecstatic with my life. And I started to implode at about 4 or 5 months sober. And finally, I called my sponsor and I told him, I said, "I've got a problem." He said, "What is it?" And I said, "I've withheld something from you." And I told him I had been underground prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been underground drinking and hiding from my parole officer. And there had been a bank robbery in San Angelo, Texas, and they caught it on videotape, and they're looking for me. And I'm a blackout drinker. I don't know anything. And he said, "You've got to go down there and talk to him." And I said, "Oh no, I'll get life. They will lock me up." He said, "Well, then get you a new sponsor, because you will not survive this." I want to condense this, but basically I prayed all night, and it boiled down to this. I just said, "God, I do not have the courage to do that. If you want me to do it, you're going to have to give me the courage." And I felt that peace again. And I knew for the first time in my life I truly stood at the crossroads. I could go on trying to protect my physical freedom and lose everything. Or I could trust this power, this God that I'd found here, and believe what you said and believe my sponsor, and I could go down there. Because I do know this, four walls do not make a prison. Prison is in here. And I was free. So I went down there the next morning. I walked in. The guy asked me where I'd been. I told him I was in AA, and I gave him my pitch. And he said, "I want to show you something." And he showed that video clip, and I saw it twice. And the second time I watched it, it was very grainy, and I thought, I am dead. I wonder what I did with the money. And he looked at that, and he looked back at me, and he said, the guy I'm looking for wouldn't walk in here. The guy I'm looking for is still out there, and we'll find him. He said, now you get your butt out of here and get back to Alcoholics Anonymous, because those people have a more of an idea of what life's about and have done more to help us keep these streets clean than any organization around. I went outside and said, I'm in AA forever. My God. It's an amazing thing. It's a true story. I mean, I can't even believe it today. I made my amends to, like you. There are amends that are important, but I'm telling you, mine is my dad. And my mom arranged this, by the way. You know, I went to make my amends when I was early sober, and she got a chair here and a chair here, got us both a cup of coffee, and stood near in case I needed an interpreter. And I said, you know, I started trying to make amends to my dad. You know, and I'm stumbling all over myself like I do right now. And he said, son, that's fine. That's fine. You know, I'm glad you're sober. I'm glad you're home. I love you. Just don't talk about it. And he went on about his life, and I went on about mine. And I don't know about you, I mean about him, but I felt that wall between us still. And it was still, we couldn't sit and talk. We couldn't be at ease with each other. And I complained to you about it. And you said, continue to be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Carry this message. Be the kind of son that you know he would like to have. Don't worry about the rewards that you think you deserve. Just get about the business of your daily living. And so I've done that. And I quit calling them with my problems. I quit calling them every time something fell apart. After about 2 years of doing that, my mom called one day. She said, your father and I feel like we could die in peace because we think you can take care of yourself. And I thought, wow. When I was 18 years sober, I was doing what you asked me to do. And I went back to Midland, Texas, where I'm from, and that's where my mom and dad live. I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and when I came home, he was already in bed, and I went to his bedroom, and I just walked in there, and he used to be he's like me. He was a big, strong, boisterous guy, and I just, he's the rock of my life, and he was laying there in bed, and his time has worn him down. He's just a little shriveled up old 82-year-old man, an old World War II veteran who's just been good to his family and good in his community. And I went back there, and I leaned down to kiss him on his bald head, and I said, I love you, Pop. And he held my head to his bare chest. And he held it, and he patted my head, and he said, I didn't know what to do. I said, me neither, Pop. I didn't know. He said, I'm proud of the man that you've become. And he said, I want you to tell those people in Alcoholics Anonymous how much we love them, how much we appreciate what they've given our family. And so that's what I do. I tell you that not only have you afforded me an opportunity to have sobriety, but you've lifted my father up and given him a gift that is priceless. I have the gift of the blessing from my father. I am now the brother. I'm the elder brother, and I have my rightful place in my family. I'm the guy that they turn to when they want somebody to help solve family problems. I don't know where you're at in your sobriety or whether you're struggling with some time or you're just on top of the world. I hope you are. I'll tell you this. This can be a rocky road. Don't go it alone. You'll find your answers on the floor. I believe very much in prayer. I don't know. I mean, I'm not telling anybody. I'm just telling you what I do. I pray, and I pray on my knees, and I talk to you about what I think I received from God. The story of my life is still being written, and I deserve a good ending to this story, and so do you. God bless you. Thank you.